Hello and welcome to Sustainable Growth Out Loud, a podcast brought to you by Sustainable Growth Voice, part of DC Thompson. I am your host, Giulia Bottaro, and I am here with my colleagues, Heather Dinwoodie and Felicia Jackson. And today we're going to talk about three stories from the past couple of weeks. We're going to put them into context, and we're going to explain to you why they're such good examples of what's going on in the world of corporate sustainability. So Heather, if you would like to start with your story of the fortnight.
Yeah, thank you, Giulia. So the story I've decided to talk about is about the global shoe brand Crocs. Basically, Crocs have come out and said that having initially set a target of achieving carbon neutrality by 2030, they've now pushed that target back until 2040. Now, this was interesting to me because the two reasons they've given for this decision come from sort of very different places, and I think both are worth talking about because people are setting carbon neutrality goals, and we need to make sure that those goals are based on some sort of reasoned plan. So the first reason that Crocs has given for delaying its goal was just that it hadn't finished calculating its emissions at the time when it set this target. So it's essentially just said, right, we're going to reduce emissions by however much we need to achieve carbon neutrality by 2030, but it had no idea how many emissions it was generating in the first place. So you've got to wonder sort of where are you starting from then? You need to have that detailed starting point to know where you're going next. Now, the second reason they gave was that since setting that goal, they have acquired another shoe brand called Hey Dude, and that has drastically increased their emissions. So I think they said from 2022's emissions, around a quarter of what was generated was from this newly acquired company. And that really raises a far bigger question when it comes to carbon planning, because in any traditional circumstance, the acquisition of a new business or the growth of a business, the continued profitability of a business depends on its growth. And these are all seen as good things. But how can we expect companies to work towards their emissions reduction targets while at the same time continuing to deliver that growth? So what I think is interesting about this story is that it really kind of highlights some of the challenges that companies are facing when it comes to delivering on carbon goals. Because we are seeing that, you know, there's been several studies out recently, and I wrote about one just the other day from MSCI that said the number of companies that are pledging to become carbon neutral is increasing. Everyone's doing it. Everyone's aiming for net zero, but no one seems to have a good plan as to how they're going to achieve it. And, you know, Crocs's example just kind of highlights two examples of when investors and stakeholders might be making decisions based on the carbon neutral goals that they're seeing, but there's no substance beneath it. And how do we find that substance? How do we convert these goals into tangible action? Is really the question that I see here.
Yeah, and I think that a 2030 carbon neutral goal is very ambitious because usually the goals are set for 2050. And so it's admirable on the one side that they did that so early, but then in the end, they might have garnered lots of praise when they first announced it, and now they're rolling it forward by 10 years. So it's like you can be as ambitious as you want, but if you don't have any substance to your ambitions, then you're never going to achieve them.
I do think there's two things here, though, because having a net zero target is obviously very important. There's a huge ambition growing in all sorts of different sectors. But I think what may have happened with some of the early movers is that the CEOs made commitments without necessarily talking it through with their ops teams. And I think there's a real difference between having ambition and stating that ambition and having the ability to actually move things forward. And one of the things we do know is that as companies have talked more about what they're doing, they have sort of admitted to the fact that it's a lot more complicated. And I think there's a level of knowledge that may not be there, because scope one and two emissions, that's fair enough. That's internal. You have some control over it. But most companies, the majority of their carbon footprint comes from their scope three emissions. That's the supply chain. That's not necessarily anything they have any control over. You know, one of the things we talk about a lot is enabling conditions and this idea that, you know, different sectors have an impact on decarbonization pathways. So how is a shoe company supposed to be able to achieve its scope three emissions reduction if it can't get access to decarbonized energy, or if the materials it uses within its supply chain are highly carbon intensive materials or commodities.
Which I believe they are in the case of Crocs.
Which would make sense.
I can't pretend I know their exact composition, but I'm thinking a lot of rubber in there.
I think there's also something else there that is really important and speaks to decision-making, understanding and credibility. And that is this issue of buying another company. Now, whether or not we believe that, you know, continued growth is the best model for the world, business today is rewarded by growth, you know, on growth. This is what investors are looking for. They're looking for return. They're looking for growth. What Crocs have done is say, we are growing, but that means that we can't actually cut our absolute emissions. What they can do is cut their relative emissions. And that brings us to the idea or the question of what methodology do you use? What's the target that's right for you?
I think you're right, Felicia. I think it's sort of, it starts becoming about emissions intensity rather than absolute emissions. So a company like Crocs could decrease its relative emissions in terms of it's got a lower emissions intensity, but it's still continuing that growth trajectory. But then you've also got the question of kind of startup businesses and smaller businesses who, you know, they're not necessarily acquiring new companies. They might not be at that stage, but they've got to grow from something, because every business, you know, essentially it starts as an idea, and ideas are net zero emissions. But how do you grow from that into a valid business while maintaining any sort of commitments?
I think actually that's potentially one of the most interesting points when it comes to climate tech and sustainability, which is that disruptive companies are trying to grow rapidly to push out high carbon targets, to push out high carbon sectors, to replace them. So even if we reject the idea of continuous growth as the optimum paradigm, we actually have to say, if we want low carbon generation, that has to grow really, really fast. So how can a company that needs to grow fast to disrupt reduce its absolute emissions on an ongoing basis, which, as you know, is a requirement if you're going to be able to sign up to a science-based target under the SBTi? And of course, that's one of the most credible certifications, recognitions that there is out there. So I think there's a real challenge for the market as a whole to work out what's the right approach for you as a business to take.
And do we change our expectations? Do we stop expecting companies to say that they're going to reach net zero by whenever? Do we actually look at the actions that they're taking rather than the goals that they're setting, I would argue?
I mean, it's a real challenge, because I know historically there were huge arguments about China not setting absolute emissions reductions and saying it was going to reduce emissions intensity over time. So there's a real ideological argument going on as well as to what's the best approach to take. And I think one of the challenges with the discussions around absolute versus relative emissions reduction is the fact that we haven't got very long to take action. We've got less than 7 years to 2030. So we kind of need both. I think we need absolute reductions to happen as soon as possible, but we need startups to grow fast to replace existing industries. And then we need everyone to be really honest and talk about what they're doing so we can grow. So yeah, no, I don't have a simple answer for this one.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot to think about. And I feel that with Crocs as well, we're just talking about emissions. So we're not even talking about the impact on nature and biodiversity and so on. And there will be a bit more about biodiversity after the break, so we can continue the discussion then.
The Scott Wind Project and its nearly 28 gigawatts of offshore wind is going to bring huge opportunities to Scotland. At the same time, it needs to be developed within the wider shift towards a sustainable low-carbon future. In this second episode of Series 2 of Gigawaters, brought to you by Sustainable Growth Voice and Energy Voice Out Loud in paid partnership with Ørsted, we're going to look at skills and jobs and how ScotWind must be developed within the context of a just transition, as well as how it can be used to help transform the lives and futures of young people. I'm joined by Benj Sykes, Head of Environment, Consenting and External Affairs at Ørsted, and Claire Kanakides, Head of Network Support at National Charity OnSide, and a trustee on the board of the new youth zone in Grimsby, known as Horizon, which is being supported by Orsted. This podcast is coming soon.
We are back from the break. As we mentioned, we were going to talk about biodiversity and the issue about setting targets for biodiversity. So, Felicia, I believe you have something for us on this.
I do. And once again, it's a story that may not seem that exciting, but actually to me, it tells us everything we need to know about the challenges around reporting on nature and biodiversity. And this is a story we did on a report by scientists at Stanford University. So they basically did a review of global biodiversity records. Now, historically, that's been around people going out and sampling. It's obviously got a lot better with digital coverage and modelling and sensors and on the ground, all this different stuff. But basically, what they found is that the data sets that exist, so the things that we're using as a baseline, the things that we're using to make comparisons, are riddled with biases, and they've got gaps in coverage because there's, you know, people are more interested in certain geographical areas. They're often more interested in certain species. And one of the things we're going to have to do is understand where we are in order to understand our impact. The reason this is so important is because, despite the fact, as we have discussed in our previous story with Heather, you know, that people are still really struggling with their carbon footprints and setting net zero targets, there is guidance coming in on how you should report on biodiversity. And as yet, we don't have robust data or, in fact, robust methodologies that allow us to do it. And this is becoming a real concern for investors. So we know from some of the research and analysis that's been done that I think it's the World Economic Forum who did an analysis that said $44 trillion worth of business operations are actually moderately or highly dependent on nature. And that's things like construction, obviously agriculture and food and beverages. But, you know, just those three actually have an economic value twice the value of Germany's economy. This is huge. This is why central banks are interested, because the potential impact on economic stability is massive. What we need to do is find different ways of reporting, different ways of understanding. There's new regulatory frameworks coming into play. We know that the EU has launched its Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. It's got its Due Diligence Directive. These are requirements to report on environmental impacts. Even the International Sustainability Standards Board, which is the US-based body and actually the same body who created the International Financial Reporting Standards, they started out very much focusing on reporting climate risk in terms of the risk to business. They've shifted to say they're going to look towards impact as well, but they've also said that in the first year of reporting, you only have to report on internal risk because it's too complicated, it's too difficult. So what are we going to do about biodiversity and nature reporting? COP15, there was an agreement. The international community came together. They said, we're going to protect 30% of land and ocean by 2030. That means fundamentally changing the way in which we address nature, the way in which we address biodiversity. But how are we going to do it? We haven't really got the framework. Even the TNFD, so the Task Force for Nature-Related Financial Disclosure, they're supposed to be releasing their planned framework in September. We've got potentially science-based targets for nature being released in the next few weeks. It's going to be, to me, it's really interesting. What are these standards going to be like? What are the methodologies going to be like? There's huge momentum for reporting and managing nature risk. I just really question whether anyone's ready. You know, we've got all these problems with carbon. How are we going to do nature?
I think what really fascinates me about this is the approach that we're taking. Because like you say, you know, we're taking the same approach that has been taken with carbon emissions, despite the fact that, you know, we're still having some issues there. And with biodiversity, it's just so much more complex. Everything is so, you know, all of these natural ecosystems are so interwoven in ways that go beyond our understanding. And you just think, when it comes to company reporting, how can you set a boundary on that? How can you say, well, our operations affect this specific part of biodiversity or this specific level of biodiversity when you have no idea how it's, you know, maybe, you know, when water hits your operations, it runs off as groundwater and affects something else that you had no idea about, you weren't even thinking about. And different companies will interweave along the supply chain. And you just think, how on earth are we going to come up with the right boundaries to set specific targets? And I don't know whether it's just a bit, you know, hippie-ish of me to say, but surely a more sort of collaborative approach to, right, we've all just got to knuckle down on reducing our impact, whatever it is.
I actually think that's a really nice point, because you're bringing out the importance of collaboration. One of the things we know is that nature, far more than CO2, really, really highlights the interconnected nature of how nature works. If you think about it, biodiversity and nature, actually, they're responsible for the quality of our air. They're responsible for pollination of food. In terms of floods, you know, they reduce it. The protection of biodiversity in nature can actually reduce the impact of floods. And of course, you know, the world's food supply wouldn't exist without it. So we know there's these interconnections. But at the same time, we have to deal with the fact that actually when we're waiting for things to be perfect, when we're waiting for things to be right, we maybe don't do anything. So I agree with you that there's something really problematic, and I really do think that nobody's ready for nature risk reporting yet. But I also think we need to encourage people to start doing it. Because one of the things that struck me about Crocs pushing back its 2030 net zero target was the massive backlash. It was all over social media. It was all over the press. You know, oh, my goodness, Crocs has dumped its target. It's moved back. The other side of the argument is to say they admitted they made a mistake. They're going to do their best. And I think we've got this real tension between needing concrete, strong, ambitious action and actually learning how to do it and what to do. I think there are definitely challenges around taking action, because I was really interested. I was looking at who's actually got concrete transition plans, for example, who's seen to have good concrete transition plans. And I think CDP did some analysis that less than 0.4% of 18,600 companies that it tracks have got robust, well-resourced plans. I think EV analysis said it was 5% of the FTSE 100, and the IPPR said 2.5% of large UK companies. These companies haven't got well-resourced, properly planned out, implementable transition plans that we can all see and understand. That's for carbon. We've got to get people to start taking action on nature and biodiversity too. And to be effective, we've actually got to allow people to make mistakes. Because this brings me back to my point about agreeing with you on collaboration. It's about openness. It's about transparency. It's about working together. I think there is a fine line between lauding a company for taking some kind of action and keeping a strict eye on them to make sure they're not misrepresenting what they're doing. But I think at the moment we've got into this incredibly binary position that is either good or bad, that isn't necessarily helpful if we're going to have any chance of achieving our long-term goals.
I was just going to say on that, I did see quite a nice example within the past week. There was BHP, which is Australia's biggest mining company, for those who don't know, have published a sort of a case study of their recent attempt to develop a framework for natural capital accounting, which, you know, that's sort of a way of valuing nature as the assets that it truly is. And their approach with putting this framework out, you know, it's not to comply with any new legislation necessarily. What it is a showcase for the rest of the industry on this is what we've done and this is how we're doing it. And it is just to encourage that sort of collaborative approach and develop the method further for when all this legislation does come in. So I suppose that's quite a nice example of someone is doing something and hopefully it'll spark off that collaboration.
Indeed. And I think a big part of collaborating is the issue of transparency as well. So sharing what you've learned in the hope that it will inspire or help other companies do the same. And I think this also brings up the issue of greenwashing, which I will talk about after the break.
I'm Andrew Dykes, content editor at Energy Voice and host of The Megawatt Hour, a podcast box set series brought to you by Energy Voice in paid partnership with BDO. This series sees us examine the state of energy storage technologies and their wide-ranging effects on energy markets. So far, over the course of our series, we've looked a lot at the big picture: grid-scale batteries, seasonal storage, and the policy and investment landscape underpinning major developments across the country. In our latest episode, we're drilling right down to the small scale to focus on where we're most likely to interact with storage technology in our daily lives, in our homes. As home energy systems become increasingly smarter, storage is set to play a greater role in how we use and consume energy, and will hopefully not only help us use greater amounts of renewables, but may even save us some money. So join me, my roster of BDO co-hosts, and a range of diverse guests from across the energy and climate sector to learn more. Look for The Megawatt Hour on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or in your regular Energy Voice Out Loud feed, wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back from the break, and I will talk about a new piece of legislation coming from the European Union. And I will also plug one of the latest projects that we've been doing at SG Voice. So last Thursday, the members of the European Parliament voted to approve two draft proposals to help consumers make more sustainable choices. So one is about green claims and one is about early obsolescence. So the one about green claims is basically tightening regulations to fight greenwashing by consumer brands. So, you know, when you go to the shop and you see products that are sustainable, natural, carbon neutral, eco-friendly, and so on. So some of us are aware of what that entails. Some of us want to do the research. Some of us have the time to do the research, but realistically, many of us don't. And so we are just led to believe what the packaging says. And with more and more people willing to even spend a premium on products that they deem sustainable, there is a real risk of money being spent on products that don't do what they are claiming they do. So the European Union is basically asking companies to substantiate these claims. So why is your product sustainable? What have you done? Is it about the ingredients, the materials, the way that it's packaged, and so on? So the new regulations will include things like, if you say that it's carbon neutral, it cannot just be based on offsetting schemes. Or if you say that your product is sustainable only when used in a certain way, then it's not. Or if only a part of your product is sustainable, then again, it doesn't count as a fully sustainable product. So the members of parliament have voted approving this proposal that we reported on in March. And then they're going to move into the negotiation stage with the member states. So hopefully this will be implemented very soon in the fight against greenwashing. Before I move to the second part of the proposals, I wanted to plug our latest project that we've been doing at SG Voice. We have started limited series. So each month we will pick a topic and we will publish a lot of great explainers and resurface some old stories that we think are relevant in the hope that it will help people learn more about said topic. So the first one is greenwashing. It's on our website from today. So go and have a look. We have explainers from the very basics of the seven types of greenwashing to how you can even not do greenwashing as a company. Moving on back to Europe. The second proposal that was approved is about early obsolescence, which is when companies make products that are designed not to last. Yeah, so you know when people from a certain generation say, you know, at my time, products used to last for decades and now they break. Well, that's on purpose because they are designed to break. Maybe they're a bit flimsy or they're hard to repair. You know, we can't open our smartphones and change the battery. You know, we might just want to buy a whole new one entirely. So the European Union wants manufacturers to design these products in a way that it makes them easy to repair. And also there is a part about guarantees. So they want companies to let people extend their guarantees so that they last longer, make guarantees very clear to understand, very clear to access even. And I think that's really great because these two proposals are part of a wider package on the circular economy. And so just essentially make products last longer, reduce overconsumption, and also prevent more waste from being created.
And I think this is so critical, this idea that you can even say it's about transparency about products as well as about what companies are doing. But you're saying we need to do more with less. You know, companies can continue to grow, but maybe we need to change the way in which we do things. I remember my grandmother being horribly, horribly shocked when I was a child that I hadn't been taught how to darn my socks. And I was like, okay. And to be fair, I learned to darn my socks over one of those weird wooden mushrooms that you sew over the wool. Really useful. Got to be honest with you, never used it in my adult life because it was a lot easier to buy another pair of socks. But that's the problem. I mean, okay, when we're talking about the redundancy of goods, we're not talking about repairing socks, but it's the principle. It's the same principle that applies. It's saying we can make things last.
I think, I mean, I tend to associate sort of planned obsolescence with maybe the tech industry as a particular example. So things like mobile phones and other consumer devices and things, you know, as you say, you can't just change the battery as easily as you once could. You can't repair this. I remember writing a while back about a case where Apple was sued for planned obsolescence because it was things like someone's screen would break and they would buy a replacement screen and it would just sort of essentially deactivate some settings on the phone. So then, yes, you've got to buy a whole new phone. Or sometimes, you know, the technology doesn't even have to break. This constant run of sort of new versions and upgrades and this and that and the next thing.
Oh, and the incompatibility.
Exactly. It's constantly pushed down your throat. So even if your phone is working perfectly, you're constantly sort of incentivized to get the next version, the updated version. And it's interesting coming back to what we were talking about with Crocs, with that sort of continued economic growth, because there is a way to do this. There is a way where companies can offer spare parts, they can offer repair services, they can transition to sort of different business models that enable them to keep the value of those resources in the economy, but without necessarily continuing that production cycle.
And I think it's that point you make about within. It's about keeping it within circulation. So you're not digging out new resources or putting increased demand on agriculture or material supply. You know, and it is a different way of looking at how we do business. And there are, you know, quite a few startups looking at this new maker's approach, repairing approach. And I think there is a real growing appetite for this sort of thing from consumers. Now, there's always going to be some people who are like, yes, but I want to get on a private jet. And, you know, if that's what you want to do, we're not going to shame you for it. But there's a different way of doing it.
But maybe there are others who would pay to learn how to darn socks. I've never learned. If someone starts up a class.
Well, you never know. I it could be a whole new line for me. New line of business. I'm going to teach people to darn socks. Yeah, no, I think after the number of years since I was taught, I might not be that good. But it's, again, it's the principle. But I think it's really interesting just to bring it back to the work the EU is doing and the fact that in the UK, there's a lot of argument and discussion about whether the government is doing enough to push us towards new business models, new innovations, new technologies. Because I think you're right, there is an association with technology when it comes to planned obsolescence. But there's also the issue of innovation and how we learn to do things differently and how we replace what's not working with something that is working. And I think we really need to focus on the ways in which we can achieve our goals by working together and by being transparent and open. And maybe it'll take regulation for us to get there, but that is definitely the direction of travel that we should be in.
And even within regulation, there's still opportunities for collaboration and for learning from each other. So that Apple case that I was speaking about earlier, that was in France, I believe. And France has actually been really forward-thinking with a lot of this regulation. And it'd be interesting to know sort of how much the EU has maybe drawn from examples like that. And then, you know, in turn, maybe the UK could draw from Europe's example. I don't think the regulation is necessarily contradictory to collaboration and inspiration.
Not at all. not at all. I just meant that sometimes it takes regulation to get companies to accelerate towards doing something, because there are a lot of different issues which all companies are facing today. There's trade-offs, there's supply chain issues, and there's inflation issues, and there's the cost of living crisis, and there's the energy crisis. It's just that if you're looking to be a resilient business in the face of climate change and the sustainability challenges that we face, then what you really need to do is start addressing these issues today before it's really just pushed down your throat.
So the takeaway is transparency, collaboration, and just do something. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. Don't forget to follow us on LinkedIn and check our website, and see you in 2 weeks.